Mr. Patch, Real One. Could you tell me how you came to join the Long Range Desert Group, Mr. Patch?
I was in the Royal Artillery and had just arrived in the Middle East and was at the artillery base depot near Cairo. And one morning, an officer called Eitzen came to the parade and asked for volunteers for the Long Range Desert Group. Well, we knew nothing about the LRDG at the time, but found out one or two details. And I volunteered with my friend Bill Morrison, with whom I'm still in contact. The idea was that we had to man a 25-pounder, which was mounted on the back of a 10-ton Mack lorry, and cart this about all over the desert. And so we were sent very quickly to Siwa, where the depot of the Long Range Desert Group was at the time. We were introduced to this gun and the rest of the crew. Bill Morrison and I were both signalers. Having got used to the gun and what it was supposed to do and what we were supposed to do, and had one or two practice shoots around Siwa, we went out with a Rhodesian patrol, S patrol, and thereupon followed the great battle of El Gatafia, which is somewhere south of Ajadabia, I think. We parked the vehicle behind a hill, and I ran up a wire to the top of the hill with Lieutenant Eitzen, who was known universally as Blitz. And so he gave directions to the gun, and they started shooting, and we shot four or five rounds at this fort. And after that, the S Patrol, the Rhodesians, went in and captured it, but they found it empty, because at the first round the entire garrison, which consisted of four Senussi soldiers of the Italian army, ran. So that was the end of the battle.
What was the name of the fort?
El Gatafia.
How do you spell that?
The Gatafia is G-T-A-F-I-A. But the this 10-ton Mack was much too big to trundle about in the desert. It was continually getting stuck in the sand, and it was so heavy it bent the sand trays. We got into a fairly difficult position on the way back from the fort, and the officer in charge of the Rhodesians, John Olivey, said, "Well, we're not going any further with this thing. We're going to abandon it." So we took the gun off the lorry, and thereafter it was towed behind one of the 30 hundredweights of the patrol, and we got back to Siwa like that.
When was the capture of this particular fort?
It was round about November 41.
What was the idea of attacking it in the first place?
This was to be one of a series of similar attacks where we would capture these isolated forts, which were used quite extensively from time to time as convoy staging posts by the enemy. But clearly this one wasn't being used particularly much at the time. Perhaps if we'd struck it a day or two later, there might have been a convoy there, I really don't know. But that was the idea, to cause havoc in remote parts of the desert by capturing and destroying these forts, so that the enemy wouldn't know where we were going to hit next. But because of the failure of the lorry, then the idea was given up. And that was the only operation made by the artillery section of the Long Range Desert Group. And it was thereafter split up sometime after Christmas 1941.
What did this particular fort look like?
It was a right old Beau Geste affair. An Italian fort. They built them at all sorts of odd places all over the desert, and it had a battlemented wall round it, and was just like
made of mud.
Well, I really didn't stop to examine it. It probably mud features an awful lot in it, but I think there was a lot of stone in it too. It was a fairly substantial looking thing. It wouldn't have stood up to much battering by artillery. In fact, when we were firing, one shot disappeared altogether and we didn't see where it had gone. But when we got into the fort, we found the shell lying there right in the middle of the fort, unexploded. So there's no doubt that we hit it.
And were these Senussi not, didn't they have Italians in command of them?
Not at the time. I think perhaps they were left for a day or two by themselves, and probably the Italians would visit them every couple of days. I really don't know the details.
Were any of them captured?
Oh yes, we captured them all. And there's a funny story attached to that too. We, the artillery section, were left in a particular spot after the action, while S Patrol went off to do some other business. I don't know what it was, reconnaissance, I think, of some kind. We had to look after these four prisoners. Although we were supposed to guard them all night, somebody wasn't too conscientious and fell asleep. So that the next morning, instead of four, there were only three. But fortunately, there was a Boy Scout instinct amongst us, and so we looked all round the place where we were stayed and found a set of footprints going away, and we followed these in a little vehicle which Blitz Eitzen normally used to use. It was called Blitz's pickup. And we followed these footprints right out into the desert and eventually came across this chap still trudging right towards his own native village. His Italian boots were slung round his neck. So we recaptured him and took him back, and he was given a mighty dressing down by the Senussi corporal.
What did the attitude of your Senussi prisoners seem to be?
They were very friendly and were really bewildered. They were total peasant types. Perhaps the corporal was a little aware of what was going on, but they didn't seem to care one way or the other, and I think they were rather glad on the whole to be out of the war.
They just seemed to have a mercenary character, did they?
Probably so, but I think they were probably conscripts into the Italian army. I really don't know the details.
Was there anything worth having when you in the fort itself?
No. Oh, no, it was very bare. And we laid a few explosive charges and destroyed it as much as we could. There was no radio and no telephone. They had no means of communicating with the outside world. So we just knocked it about as much as we could and left it. And no doubt it had its effect when the next convoy arrived, when they found that the place was a wreck. I suppose from that point of view we fulfilled the idea of going there in the first place.
Where is this place located?
It's south of Agidarbia. It's fairly well west. It's not so far west as Tripoli, but a good deal west of Benghazi. It's sort of southwest of the Jebel Akhdar, which was the green part of the northern desert, which was about the only fertile area in the country that we covered.
Some people might be surprised to hear about this attack on the fort, because they probably had the concept of the LRDG as being a reconnaissance group.
We were, by and large, but I think Bagnold, when he first had the idea of forming the LRDG and put it to General Wavell, said that we would be most useful for reconnaissance, but there seemed to be no reason why we shouldn't add a little bit of piracy to it.
And also they might be surprised with the idea of the LRDG having an artillery section.
Yes, well, it didn't last very long. I think there was another idea in which we are going to have some rather smaller guns than the 25-pounders, but the 25-pounder having been proved a failure, I don't think that was ever followed up. Mind you, we did have a Bofors gun attached to, I think there was one attached to each patrol for a time, but this was before I arrived. When I came, we had an Italian 20mm Breeder to each patrol, and they were dreadful things. They'd never fire more than four or five rounds before they jammed.
When you left the Royal Artillery to go into the Desert Group, what kind of impression did the Desert Group make on you after being in a regular unit like the RA?
Oh, I was highly delighted to be with them, because clearly one was given a lot of individual initiative and freedom, and the normal military discipline was supplanted by a very strong self-discipline, and we realized at once that if we didn't pull our weight and do our job as we were supposed to, then we'd be out on our necks right away.
Were there any people who joined it for whom that kind of discipline didn't suit practice?
Indeed, yes, and they were sorted out very quickly.
By whom?
Well, first of all, by the rest of the chaps, and then by the officers. You could see at once whether a chap was suitable or not. Some of them were far too cheeky. They would realise that there was this lax, as you might say, military discipline, without the obligatory saluting and the standing to attention and the polishing of boots and the whitewashing of stones and all the rest of it. But certain people would feel so free by the lack of this discipline that they'd start calling the commanding officer by his Christian name and that kind of thing, and this did happen. And they were sorted out once and sent back. And some chaps tended to be flamboyant and boast about what they were doing and simply didn't fit in. It was easy to sort them out, and they were sent back to their units right away.
Were some people just lost because of the removal of a rigid military discipline?
No, I didn't notice that at all. Most chaps, and after all, we were only selected after interview with the officers who knew what they were doing and what they were talking about and the sort of people they wanted, and very few men who were not suitable slipped through that sort of interview. And so I don't think there was a question of anybody being lost. If they were unsuitable, it showed at once, and they were sent back.
You were talking about the Rhodesians. What were relationships like between the British and Rhodesians? Did there seem to be much difference between them?
No, it was very friendly. I got my first ideas about navigation from one of the Rhodesian navigators on this patrol to El Gatafia. I found them friendly and also very inventive. They do things like fixing up a shower in places like Siwa, where we would have our bases. And if we wanted to borrow their facilities, then they were perfectly willing to lend them to us. They're a good lot. And so are the New Zealanders.
Were they of a similar character to the Rhodesians?
Yes. They were chosen in the first place by Ralph Bagnold because amongst the New Zealanders, there tended to be more people like farmers and people who were used to earning their living by themselves and living by means of their own initiative. And this was the sort of chap that Bagnall wanted in the long-range desert group. And So he staffed the group with New Zealanders, and as he'd taken rather a large number of New Zealanders from the New Zealand Army, he felt, I suppose, or was told that he couldn't have any more, and so he cast about him for other similar people, and the next people he chose were the Rhodesians, who tend to have a similar sort of background to the New Zealanders. After the Rhodesians, he chose the Guards Brigade, who would perhaps have a different background, but they were tip-top soldiers with a lot of self-discipline instilled into them. And that worked out very well, too. And having chosen the guardsmen, he cast about him still further, and the next people he came to were the yeomanry regiments of the British Army. And this is how Y Patrol was formed. And Y Patrol was the patrol which I eventually joined when the RA section was disbanded. And they were from quite a variety of yeomanry regiments. They came from the Yorkshire Hussars and the Cheshire Yeomanry and the North Somerset Yeomanry, the Staffordshire Yeomanry, to name but a few. And I mixed in with them very well. They seemed to be my type of chap, and so I was very happy with them. I started off as a gunner. They gave me a Lewis gun, which I nurtured, and actually fired it in anger at the enemy aircraft. And later on, I trained as a navigator. And my knowledge of the Morse code didn't really come into it at that stage, although it was useful later.
You were going to say?
No, I wasn't going to say anything. I was stumbling as usual.
Was this using Bagnall's Sun Compass?
Oh, yes, yes.
How did it work?
Beautifully. It was a fine precision instrument. And you had to get used to using it and being able to average out the bearing on which you're travelling, and also being able to estimate the distance over the ground that you've travelled, because when you're weaving in and out and going up and down over steep slopes, then that is very different from the distance which you travel on the map. And so that was the main problem in dead reckoning. But I got used to it very quickly, as we all did, of course. I'm not claiming any particular merit there. But I think the highlight of my navigating career was after we'd been into Tobruk. We took some commandos into Tobruk in, I think it was September 42, it would be. We had to leave the Tobruk area before dawn and push off out into the desert. And we had to make lots of detours for bad country. We had to stop for aircraft. We had to dodge about an awful lot. And we didn't stop until after dark. And when I'd made my cross on the map, which was where my dead reckoning had brought us, it happened to be right next to a trig point marked on the map. And so I said to the skipper, that's David Lloyd Owen, look, if I'm right, we are right here by this trig point, and I would say the trig point is up on top of that hill. We'd stopped right by a hill. Do you mind if I don't take a star shot if I can find that that trig point on top of the hill? Because we were very tired, we'd had no sleep. So he said that was all right. So I went up the hill, fumbling my way in the dark, and I found the trig point, and there I was, absolutely spot on. I was very pleased with myself that night.
Can you tell me more about this expedition into Tobruk?
Well, it was a tragedy, really. We took these commandos who were in three British three-tonners with Africa Corps markings on them. and there were German-speaking Jews, I understood they were, in German uniform, and the idea was that we would take them to a spot where they could locate the coast road, and they would drive along the coast road into Tobruk as prisoners of war. And they would then disperse, having got into the Tobruk perimeter. They would make for the port installations and the defence guns and attack them and silence them and enable a large party of Marines to land from two destroyers. And all this was to be preceded by a severe bombing from the Air Force, and they were to cause as much mayhem in Tobruk as they could, and then get out, so far as I understand, as best they could. We were not given any instructions to get them out. Our part was to navigate them to the perimeter of Tobruk, wait for darkness when we would go into Tobruk ourselves, and we would attack a radar station there, release a lot of prisoners from a prisoner of war cage which we knew was there, and then get out as best we could, carrying presumably these prisoners with us. I forget the details, but having waved goodbye to these commandos disguised as prisoners of war, we waited for dark and we went into Tobruk with no trouble at all. And the idea was that we would contact the commandos by radio, but we never did. They didn't come up on the air at all. We simply couldn't contact them. So we found a depression in the ground and stayed there out of sight from the searchlights, which by then were playing all round Tobruk, presumably looking for us and for any other enemy that might be approaching, trying to contact the commandos, but we never did. And that being so, David Lloyd Owen said, well, we are not going any further unless we do contact the commandos. And this situation persisted all night. We stopped two or three vehicles, I think it was, going into and coming out of Tobruk, and destroyed them. And when dawn was about to break, David Lloyd Owen said, well, there's nothing to do but get out of it. Which is what we did. We drove back along the road and then cut off the road through all the enemy encampments there and up onto the escarpment at El Adam and away. We then made for an area of scrub where we could hide up. Now, what was the name of that? I can't remember at the moment. But we stayed there for the next day. And then we were ordered to go to a place called Landing Ground 125, which was south of Barchi, where we were told that the remnants of the guards and New Zealand patrols who had attacked Barchi were in some trouble. So we went to Landing Ground 125 and couldn't see anybody or anything there. And we arrived just as darkness fell, and stopped there, and before long a little figure appeared on the limits of our vision there, and so he had a number of rifles and machine guns trained on him, but he turned out to be a New Zealander, a chap called Jack Davis, and he was a navigator. And he was about to navigate this small party of wounded people who had been left behind on Landing Ground 125 with the medical officer, Dick Lawson. And I think they had one vehicle. But they'd have had an awful lot of trouble getting back to Kufra, which was our base at the time. And so they were very glad to see us. You see, Jack Davis had spotted us arriving, but we hadn't seen him. The wounded people, who included Nick Wilder and Popsky, were lying in a makeshift tent under a tarpaulin on the outskirts, on the edge of this landing ground, with Doc Lawson. So we informed our headquarters in Kufra of the situation, and the next day a Bombay aircraft arrived to pick up the wounded and take them back to hospital in Cairo. And that was a very courageous thing to do on the part of the RAF, because the Bombays were dreadful, lumbering, slow old aircraft, and to fly all that way across enemy territory was quite a courageous thing to do. And the pilot of the aircraft was a man called Bill Coles, who finished up as an air marshal, and he figured in a BBC This Is Your Life program once upon a time. And the BBC flew in a few of the people who had been in that party that he picked up, in particular a chap called Snow Parker, one of the New Zealanders, and Doc Lawson featured on the program too. It was quite an event. But at the time, there he was in this slow old aircraft, and he made it. It was a great show.
You talked about the destruction of some vehicles coming out of Tobruk. Can you say more about that?
Not a lot. They weren't armoured vehicles. I think they were both staff cars. I think there were two. I can't remember. There might have been three. I really can't remember.
But no resistance from them?
Precious little. They were being fired at from the dark, and were totally bewildered and gave up at once.
Was anybody captured from them?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Were they senior officers?
No, I don't think so.
Did you see much of Pop's game?
Not a great deal. He was on the Barchi raid. He had a finger shot off his hand, and the story afterwards was that he was firing his machine gun in Barchi, and suddenly the little finger from one of his hands disappeared, and he said, "Oh damn, I've lost a finger," and went on firing.
What kind of a chap was he?
Oh, solid sort of character. Inclined to be a bit flamboyant if you let him get talking. I didn't know him particularly well, but he later formed this private army. In fact, I think it was David Lloyd Owen that gave it the name PPA, Popsky's Private Army, and they survived right through the desert campaign, and it